Back together again, you and I chatting it up. Fast moving Thursday show, February 6, 2025 on Connecticut Today. We did an extended segment with Only in Bridgeport blogger Lenny Grimaldi to primarily talk about some possible charter revisions for Bridgeport. Columnist and blogger Chris Powell commented on the latest Connecticut news and the state's stubborn pockets of poverty and school underachievement. CBS News Justice Department correspondent Scott McFarland jumped on board to talk about the FBI staff firing situations. And I had some thoughts during the show on state teacher and municipal officials' reactions to Governor Ned Lamont's budget address earlier in the week.
I'm telling you, with bated breath, we wait for this guy's segment. Every Thursday right around this time, I seriously have people around the station saying, "Hey, I heard you and Lenny the other night." In fact, Lenny Grimaldi, there are people at this radio station, the only segment they have told me they listen to, because they can't stand my right-wing lunacy, they listen to you and I together. How about that?
Uncle Paulie, you sound like someone who just sucked down a dried, hard-boiled egg, followed by a dry can of tuna.
It's been a little head cold,
better,
Lenny.
You did at 2 o'clock.
Little head cold. I'm feeling a little bit better. Well, it's one of these things, Lenny, where I actually felt good all day, but the throat had to clear up a little bit, so we're good.
Tell me the truth.
The truth. All right. So we're bringing Lenny on a little bit early today. We got a lot to go on. And, Lenny, you wanted to talk about, is Bridgeport finally going to go down the road of a possible charter revision here, which would, I guess, Lenny, at the extreme end, restructure the city government? What do you have for us?
Yeah, well, I think that now is the time if they want to do it, right? The city council hasn't authorized the impaneling of a charter revision commission that would review the charter. That's, you know, basically the city's governing document. Mm-hmm. Where it can make changes. The question is the structure. Easier said than done. You have to put a panel together. You have to have a chair, to know how, someone who knows process, and you have to have someone with some kind of vision of what are we going to look at and what are we not. So, I like to cause a little trouble, so I decided to float some things that they could look at. For instance, do you want to reduce the size of the city council from 20 members to 10 and maybe make some of them at large? Because a lot of people feel that, it's a little unwieldy. There's 20 members, 10 districts, 2 per district. Mm-hmm. A lot of city council members want to be paid. They do put a lot of time in it.
Sure.
They receive stipends. So why don't we get rid of the stipends and pay them? How about reducing the size of the council to 10 members and pay them $20,000 a year and with index it every year, cost of living increases, right? I have in my head for a long time. I feel if you work in Bridgeport, you have skin in the game. And I keep hearing the meowing from City Hall. It's hard to find really good people to fill boards and commissions, right? So why not open that up to include appointment to boards and commissions of people who work in Bridgeport? Because they have skin in the game, right? A lot of city employees don't live in Bridgeport. They work there. They work there and they go to their suburban homes, right? Mm-hmm. So why not have people in the suburbs who have something to bring to the table?
Interesting,
right?
Yeah.
I'm a big believer in minority party representation.
Okay.
I'd like to see it on the city council. You got 20 Democrats. It's all the same. Why not,
So how would you do that? How would you, Lenny? Because I get callers, Lenny. You hear them all the time. My God, if we could just get one or two Republicans or one independent party person. How do you do that?
Well, you have it on the Board of Education. It's state mandated.
Yeah.
Right? So you have 9 members on the Board of Education in Bridgeport. 3 of them must have minority party status. That could be Republican. As you pointed out earlier, it could be the independent party. Mm-hmm. We have representation on that board now, and from that party. It could be the Working Families Party. We have representation on that currently on the school board. So why not make, a third of them a minority party? This is a stretch, right? It is a stretch. But if I'm Mayor Joe Gann, I'm going, why the heck not? I mean, it's like, let's get some different ideas to the table. You don't have to deal with, some of it. some of the people on the council, they're just nuts, right?
Hey, Lenny, do me a favor and don't hold back. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. Don't hold back.
I have to deal with them. And I also feel like I call them, you know, it's a little insensitive. I call them like they're cripples. They rely on someone stronger. So you got two per district. Mm-hmm. And they're really relying on someone who's stronger in the district. And they just kind of go along. Right. So, you know, these are the things that, you know, I'd like to see them look at.
Sure.
But, you know, again, I don't know if it's going to happen. So because there is a timeline, mm-hmm, by state law that has to be followed. So if this is going to be on the ballot in November,
yeah,
for voters to decide, because the voters decide this. This is just not, you know, casting, you know, a wave of the hand and saying,
no,
this,
yeah,
is going to be done. This is a commission that would look at reforming the charter, questions on the ballot for the voters to decide. And if it's going to be done, they have to get going. Now, there's, you know, in the past, what have been really critical charter changes? The four-year term for mayor, 1998. It happened, mm-hmm, two times. The mayoral appointment of the police and fire chief, mm-hmm, to no more than 2 5-year terms. You know, I think that's been pretty successful,
yeah,
in four. And those are the kinds of things that have happened. It was in the late 1980s. The city had something called a Board of Apportionment and Taxation. It was a de facto finance commission. Mm-hmm. The voters decided they want the city council, you know, to handle the budget. You know, that goes back and forth, arguments pro and con. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a real good opportunity for the city to take a look at this and do something about it, and, you know, do something out of the box.
Our weekly check-in every Thursday, double dip today with Lenny Grimaldi, the website only in Bridgeport. .com. Lenny, I had a lot of stuff I want to get to here in a short time. The Success Village situation that we've been right on here on the station for months now, Melissa leading the way on that. So where do we stand on that, and how's the situation shaking out there with the special master?
So that would be Barry Knott, attorney,
yeah,
Barry Knott,
yeah,
who's a Stratford-based attorney appointed by the court to oversee and fix the mess that was caused by the previous board that is no longer in existence. So he filed his latest report to the court this week, mm-hmm, that shows Sussex Village, and he itemizes everything. There's basically $5 million in a hole.
Wow.
And, right. I mean, it's the problem is they owed the tax. So for your audience, there's 2,000 residents and 1,000 units at Sussex Village, split between Bridgeport and Stratford. And the owners there pay $500 a month to be applied to, you know, maintenance,
mm-hmm,
tax,
yeah,
covering utilities. Those things weren't paid. So Sussex Village owes $1.7 million of taxes to Bridgeport, $325,000 to the town of Stratford, $1.5 million to utilities. What Barry Knott is looking at is maybe, you know, doing one large loan, mm-hmm, right, to pay all this stuff off. But, you know, the good news is progress has been made. You're talking about, you know, people who had no heat and hot water for months and months and months.
Yeah.
Well, the heat and hot water is back on, but it's an old, antiquated jalopy of a system. This complex was built in the aftermath of World War II. You have essentially the same boiler infrastructure system as when it was built. And so that still creates some problems. So when you get into the warmer weather now, you know, we're getting into March and April, some of the workers there will have more flexibility to get in there, install some new boilers, mm-hmm, and look to the future so this doesn't happen again. He's going to be on board for a while. Now, simultaneously to this, there's a law enforcement investigation into where did the money go.
Yeah, that's what everybody asked me. Hey, what happened to that Success Village money? I have no idea. The cops are on that, right?
There's a forensic audit going on. You know, Barry Knott has hired people to look where the money went, but also you've got federal investigators, state, and even federal, state, and local investigators looking, following the money trail. to see where this money went, because money is just missing. It's just completely missing. So all this stuff wasn't paid, right? Millions of dollars that was supposed to be paid on behalf of the residents there was not paid.
Mm.
They're following this, and it takes a while. It takes a while to follow the money trail. They're gonna find out about it, and we'll see what happens. But the good news is, at least the heat and hot water is on.
Yeah,
and there's still a lot of once you start pulling back the layers of the onion for something that's been screwed up for so long, you're gonna find some additional rot that has to be addressed. And I'm happy for the residents. I stay on top of the story all the time, and Barry Knott, he's a good person. For this time, and take a look at this.
Yeah, that's what you hear. A couple more things, Lenny. Number one, the Bridgeport delegation hearing the governor's budget address earlier this week. Are they happy with what he said or not?
Yeah, I think on the broad strokes they are. But as I wrote today in a column, all of this is a work in progress. The governor's budget is just a starting point. That's all it is. And so right now you have the budget analysts looking at what this means to Connecticut's largest city. And Bridgeport has the largest delegation in the state. It has 9 members. And it's the best delegation I've seen in a long time. They work as a unit. They're smart. Got a lot of new young minds involved in the legislature. And they have rescued a number of Bridgeport budgets in the last several years where, what the governor proposed really wasn't enough. And they go to leadership and they say, hey, we need this, for Bridgeport to hold the line on taxes. And that's the key thing. What happens in Hartford is really, really key to what happens with the local budget in Bridgeport. And that's the reason why Joe Ganim hasn't raised taxes in 10 years. Right. But he still wants to do more in economic development. And you hit on some really interesting points, earlier about, where does the state spend money and why do we have all these poverty levels?
They spend in the wrong area.
And when you were talking about that earlier, I looked at Dan Mulley's eight years as mayor, as governor, excuse me.
Yeah.
Most of the stuff he wired was to Stanford. That was his hometown. Stanford got everything. He was very, very lazy. He didn't say, hey, let's have an economic development plan for Bridgeport or New Haven, wherever you're from. It's like governors just don't say, Lowe Weicker did it, for his 4 years. But, how about the leaders of economic development in the state saying, let's meet with Bridgeport. Let's see what the priorities are. And let's make that a real priority to create some jobs and eliminate the poverty. They just don't do that.
Yeah.
I think this governor has been pretty good. I think Lamont's been pretty good regarding Bridgeport. There's more that he can do. But there's not that will, to get that done, to say, we got to turn their cities around because
Absolutely.
Those are the economic engines that help the outer areas. The better Bridgeport does, the better Lowell for Fayetteville County does.
Well, thank you. And that's the point. Finally, in about the 30 seconds we have left, new Bridgeport police recruits going to be hitting the street here, right?
Yeah. And Chief Porter, he's really good at promoting his people. He was yesterday, he highlighted the 10 female recruits coming out of his class. And, he has them, he has them tell their story into the camera, why they decided to, join the Bridgeport Police Department. The policing is, with this chief, it's very, very community-based, which is really great to see. So it's nice to see the diversity, the inclusiveness. So this class of, 35 or so or 40, I'm not an exact number, 10 of them are females. Mm. And that's a good, healthy dimension to have in the Bridgeport PD.
And finally, Lenny, I have to ask you, your old boss, he certainly is flipping tables and smashing things in D.C., isn't he? I talked to I don't know whether you heard the CBS reporter I had on early today, Scott McFarland. He said this is just, he's never seen anything like this, or his compatriots in the D.C. press corps haven't either.
Yeah, my former boss is like a kid with matches and gasoline, right? Let's wake up this morning and have some fun, And when I worked for him, that's what he would do. He's in a really interesting position right now because he's controlling. Republicans have the House, the Senate, the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And I think his attitude is, I'm going to push this stuff.
Sure.
As I can push it. you know, maybe some of it's a bluff. Maybe some of it's a negotiating tactic.
Yep, yep.
I'm going to push it. Yeah, there's going to be a lot of court action. But, I mean, he's just, you know, he's going to be 79 years old in June.
I know.
No one's going to challenge him on a lot. I mean, the courts will, right? People will run into the courts like the attorneys general, and that's great.
Sure.
But, I mean, he feels secure that, hey, I'm going to be 79. This is probably going to be it. Maybe not, but I'm gonna enjoy these, you know, 4 years as much as I can and see what I can get out of it.
That's it.
You know, that's how he operates. It's like, you know, he's, you know, what you see is what you get.
That's it. Lenny Grimaldi, the website, OnlyInBridgeport.com. Lenny, as usual, we thank you. Have a good weekend, man. We'll talk next week. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
All right, Lenny, there you go. Yes, and one of the great voices we like to tap into from time to time, the one and only Chris Powell. Check out all his columns, ChrisPowellColumn.com, ChrisPowellColumn.com. Chris, a keen observer, as we like to say, of the state of confusion right here in the great state of Connecticut. Mr. Powell, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I'm good, Paul. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you, Chris, because you're a breath of fresh air, a spot of clarity, whatever any phrase I can use.
Well, that's why I brush my teeth.
And every once in a while, you and I put down the shivers and we can talk, yes. Well, one of your columns that is out, again, a favorite but sadly still relevant topic here is, again, the parties that be in Connecticut saying one thing, doing another, especially when it comes to poverty here, which seems to be this overriding issue that you so eloquently remind us is still probably issue one.
Yeah, it really, I think, is the underlying issue of all our problems, that we don't really do anything to reduce poverty in the state. Everything we seem to be doing seems to be increasing it. You know, if you read the papers fairly closely, you just see all this clamor for more spending to help, you know, these poor people and these other poor people and the employees of the, you know, nonprofit social service groups that, you know, help all these poor people. And the poverty never goes away.
Mm.
You know, I'm of an age now where I'm beginning to notice this stuff doesn't work. I think the first conference I went to as a young reporter to cover it was something in West Hartford about, you know, what are we going to do about the concentration of poverty in the cities? You know, maybe that was around, you know, 1969, 1970.
Yeah.
So, you know, here we are, you know, 50, 60 years later, and it's worse. And we keep appropriating money in the name of alleviating poverty, but it doesn't get better. The cities are continue to decline. Their schools are performing horribly. And we keep doing the same things. I mean, the governor proposed yesterday he wants to start an endowment for preschool for poor kids, which I think is the illusion of action. I mean, if you wanted to get preschool, you could just appropriate it directly now. But you know, instead, he wants to start a fund that would endow free preschool. Well, you know, is that really going to be it? I mean, look, my main hobby horses here, you know, first we, with the welfare system, we take the fathers away from the poor kids. And then with the school system, we have social promotion tells them, look, you don't have to learn a damn thing. We're going to promote you all the way through and even give you a high school diploma if you come out illiterate. And, you know, I keep asking the educators, you know, how does this help the poor? I've never gotten an answer.
Yeah, Chris, you're right. It's been going on since you said exactly what I was going to say, mid-1960s here, and it never changes. It never gets better. We never even see any incremental change. And now you have some of these cities seemingly, Chris, and my head's cracking on this. I'm sorry, with this irresponsible, I think, at even best, from the governor on down, these vilifying of ICE agents here and scaring these kids half to death and their parents here. And now you point out that even a major Connecticut city here is trying to say, well, we never said
We were a sanctuary city, technically. You know, listen, a lot of people can hate Trump, Chris. You and I know that, and a lot of people do that you and I talk to, but they're facing something on this that I don't think they ever thought they would face.
Well, I ask, when Biden and the Democrats opened the borders, did anybody make provision for the housing that would be needed by the 11 or 12 or 14 million people who came in unvetted? Were any preparations made for their medical care, for their policing, or was this just something we weren't supposed to notice? The cities have been burdened by all the extra costs of educating the kids who came in illegally with their parents, and these costs are really doubly burdensome because most of the kids don't speak English.
Mm-hmm.
Now, were any preparations made for this when Biden opened the borders? There were no preparations at all that was made for this sudden increase in population, and particularly not in the cities. And I think they did it because they figured, what the hell, this will be an inconvenience in one respect, but in the other respect, we'll put all these people into Democratic areas and Democratic cities, and in the next congressional districting, even though they can't vote, they will be counted for population purposes, and they'll be counted for congressional redistricting purposes, and we'll get 20, 25 more permanently Democratic districts out of it. And it'll be like the old slavery provision in the Constitution, where they counted slaves as three-fifths of a person for redistricting purposes. Well, now we're gonna count these people who can't vote as 100% of a person. And they'll be in Democratic districts, or they'll be in districts that will be made more Democratic. And, we'll have this permanent underclass that at least will be forming all these extra Democratic districts. Now, the human suffering and the inconvenience and the expense, I think that was just concern to them. But, nobody asked the governor, when the governor was asked the other day, what would you say to all the immigrants in Connecticut, legal and illegal? And he said, you're welcome here. I mean, he will make no distinction between legal and illegal immigration, no distinction between admitting people who are, vetted, investigated, checked out for their intentions, and people who are evil intended and are not checked out for their intentions. The governor will not make any distinction between those two groups. This is all madness. You're talking about being mad at Trump and his craziness, and I'm really not aspiring to be Governor General of Greenland or Gaza or the manager of the Panama Canal.
Yeah,
however,
but
he is beginning to enforce immigration law, which I think is crucial. I think not enforcing it was effectively treasonous. He's getting rid of this transgender nonsense. And if that's the only two things we get out of him, I'll be glad we got that much.
Chris Powell is the guest. And Chris, this at a time, the same thing here in Connecticut. And my jaw hit the floor the other day when Owen, it's probably going to cost $250 million. To ensure anyone who's an undocumented migrant from 15 or 16 all the way up to 2026. So here you have, as you said in your upcoming column, a lot of these clergy members and people in these charities saying, hey, we need more money. But do any of them, Chris Powell, even say a word about the state seriously saying, well, it may cost another $250 million, but you can't have the 1 or 2 million you want for people in the field trying to help the poor and impoverished here? As you say, it's madness.
Look, every budget is a matter of choosing. I think Charles de Gaulle said it best. The old saying was to govern is to choose. De Gaulle revised that to say that to govern is always to choose among disadvantages.
Yep.
The problem I have with the clergy people is, they're always whining for more for this social justice cause and that social justice cause, but they're not willing to tell us, where we should get the money and what choices we should make. It's very easy to say spend more on this and spend more on that. Well, okay, guys, Where's the money supposed to come from? Do you think we should keep, for example, we should keep giving, you know, these huge raises to state employees every year? Or maybe you know, would that money be better spent on your social causes? Mm-hmm. They'll never answer the question. I mean, they're just posturing.
Chris, keep the faith, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. How about that? Will that work now? Can we even say that anymore?
You mean darn the torpedoes?
Yes. Yes. Chris Powell, check it out. His columns are all there. You can comment, too. How about that? ChrisPowellColumn.com, ChrisPowellColumn.com. Chris, we will talk in a few weeks. Thank you, sir. Appreciate the time,
thank
as
you,
always.
Paul.
All
Bye-bye.
Right, Chris, thank you.
All right, what in the heck is going on in D.C., especially now we hear with the FBI and the Justice Department, all that. Return visit from CBS News Justice Department correspondent Scott McFarland there in D.C. to try and lay this out for us. Scott, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Oh, it's good to talk to you. Two things immediately occur to me. First of all, what an evergreen question. What the heck's going on in
well,
D.C.?
Well, I mean,
more than ever.
Yeah, my old college journalism professors, they would like that. You know, simple question, who, what, where, when, why. So what is going on there, Scott?
I got no explanation for this. This is an intensity of a fire hose, the likes of which we didn't see in the first Trump administration. And we're only 2 weeks in here. I can tell you, just as somebody who covers this every day on a granular level, there's an exhaustion already among those trying to push back on some of what the administration's doing, for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. And that may make some of these changes more impactful. I mean, they're flooding the zone with big demonstrative things, and there's only so much bandwidth, you know, the resistance has. Mm. That may be part strategy or part happenstance, but it's a real issue right now. And before I break down what's going on at the FBI,
yeah,
which I think is the most important of all the things, I'll tell you what I noticed over the first 2.5 weeks. The most salient pushback is really coming from Connecticut's two senators.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris Murphy has found a footing here as a lead voice for Democrats, a party that have no leader right now. They have no person to rally around. Chris Murphy is taking a lot of his time and effectively communicating the Democrats' response to this. And Richard Blumenthal, right there in the middle of these messy confirmation hearings for Kash Patel, the would-be new FBI director, mm-hmm. was quite vocal in pushing back on Pam Bondi.
And it's happening, I think, Scott, because you have Mr. Blumenthal, as you said, and Mr. Murphy kind of on both ends of the spectrum here, one younger, one older, one on the back end of his Senate career, and one who a lot of people, Scott said, if Kamala Harris had won, may have ended up being Secretary of State. He was one of the finalists here, so his star is certainly rising, and he's part of the Senate leadership, so I don't think anybody's surprised what we're hearing from Chris Murphy.
I tell you, I put a lot of early investment in his stock if I was one of those political day traders.
Mm-hmm.
We're in an odd numbered year. We're in a non-election year. Everything is, at this point, wide open for everybody to try to make a name or footing for him or herself. There's a handful of people around the country I'm watching who've been particularly effective in this first month or two. He's on that short list. He's filling a void.
Yeah,
where people want to hear what's going to be done about it, trying to rally the troops, trying to galvanize. He's a really good galvanizer right now,
mm-hmm.
and he has all the raw materials of vertical ascent politically.
So finally, Scott, so what is happening particularly with the FBI here, and what is Pam Bondi's role in this whole thing?
Yeah, so many things happening all at once, but this to me is by orders of magnitude the most significant.
Mm-hmm.
And here's why. And I'm not trying to say the other changes aren't big. But at the FBI, there has been a compilation of a list of about 5,000 FBI employees and agents who were part of the January 6th investigation, a particularly controversial move to make that list. Trump's allies said they wanted it to potentially purge the Justice Department because they believe January 6th prosecutions and investigations were a, quote, grave injustice.
Mm-hmm.
That is a baseless claim, but nevertheless, the list has been produced, and these agents and employees are worried about two things. That they're about to have their careers ended because they followed orders and investigated a horrific federal crime, and that that list is going to get out, and they're going to be at risk of violent retaliation by the rioters and their sympathizers.
Scott McFarland, CBS News. Scott, thank you. Appreciate the time. Great stuff, and we'll chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
Right back at you.
appreciate it. Thanks, Scott McFarland. You know, I'll say right up front, this is not an attack on teachers. It really isn't. I'm fully sincere in saying that. I have not officially taught a day in my life. I have family and good friends of mine who are teachers at all levels, at the elementary school level, at the college level, at the high school level, at the junior high level. And I marvel at what they do and how they do that every day, dealing with a variety of kids and students who come from varied backgrounds and who really make an effort to get our best and brightest ready for the next generation of leadership. But, you know, I'm reading all the stuff post the governor's budget address the other day. And like clockwork, and this always seems to happen. And again, I feel I have to say this again. I'm not attacking teachers. I'm really not. I'm not attacking school systems. Really not. However, you know, I'm looking at all the headlines here regarding what the governor said about what he wants in his budget. Now, again, that could be changed, obviously. But the governor, it says right here, I mean, in the story today, for example, pick one here. They're all over the state. They're in all the Hearst papers. They're in the Day of New London. They're in the Hartford Courant. Governor Lamont's budget proposal worries some state education leaders and advocates. And they use a quote here, Hearst does, not nearly enough. Well, my basic question is this, and I'd love to hear from you school teachers out there, and you'll excuse me, you can tell I'm still a bit under the weather here, battling this head cold. Happens to me every time this year, so I ask your indulgence with that. When is enough enough? In other words, and again, this is not to be anti-teacher, anti-school system, but when is, in other words, everybody, every department, whether it's a city or town department, whether it's a state department, state level, whether it's a federal department, you have to submit a budget, and you have to know what you can work with. And usually those departments, although nobody is going to turn down extra money, I mean, come on, nobody does that. But you never hear teachers, administrators, school systems, local, state, or national say, hey, that's enough. We're good with that money. You never really hear that, do you? So my question here is this. When is enough money enough? Now, maybe it's never enough. Is that the scenario that we deal with today when we're trying to fund our schools, both on a state, local, and even a national level? Is it just the automatic response that we just need more money? Is money the be-all and end-all of this thing? Is there ever enough money? What is enough money? What should a teacher, what should the starting salary for a teacher be here in Connecticut? I don't know. You tell me. What should, I mean, there was a proposal a couple of, was it about a year ago or two coming off of COVID? Year and a half ago saying, hey, let's take whatever leftover COVID money we have and let's lop it in with local salaries. And let's have the starting teacher salary in Connecticut be, what was it? It was floated to be $60,000 or something like that. Is that the answer? Is money always the answer? Or is the talk always about money? Because there are such different variables in this whole thing that nobody can control. The parenting, the upbringing of a kid, whether a kid, you know, a child of whatever age, biologically becomes a special needs kid. You know what I'm talking about here. There's a lot of variables. But what is, are we kidding ourselves in saying every budgetary cycle, whether it's in our cities or towns or in our state locales, every budgetary cycle, there's always the constant, whether it comes from the teachers' unions or the school superintendents, well, that's not enough. We need more. I have a simple question. What's enough? What is enough? And again, I'm not trying to be callous here. I'm not trying to pit A versus B here. But that's a question I think a lot of people, taxpayers on a local level and on a higher level, tend to ask. Okay, what's enough then? You see what I'm going at here? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. And I'd love to hear from you teachers out there. I know I have a lot of active duty teachers still plying the profession, thank you. We've got a lot of retired teachers, paraprofessionals, and educators out there, you know, still doing the best that you can every day. I get that. People involved here. But what exactly, this is the question I start with today. What's enough? What is enough? Is there ever a scenario where you have teachers and school systems saying, hey, that's good. We're all set. We have enough money. Or is the standard response to any budgetary proposal, hey, that's nice, but it's not enough? So the teachers unions, a lot of municipal experts, a lot of municipal leaders, I should say, they are not real happy with what they didn't hear yesterday from Governor Ned Lamont regarding education funding in the state. And it always happens. After every State of the State address, after every budget address, there's always this, there's always this panting, there's always this criticism that we're not spending enough on education. Well, what's enough? How do we gauge? You see what I'm saying here? What is the point? Or is there a point? Can we even figure this out? What is the point where spending more money won't make a difference? Because there is a point. I don't care whether it's education, whether it's building a bridge, whether it's putting up a new building, whether it's whatever. There is a point where you get, what is that thing, the point of diminishing returns? You know, it's like when these public polling outfits, whether it's at schools like Quinnipiac or Sacred Heart or UConn or networks or newspapers like Emerson and the New York Times and Siena College, people say, well, they should, you know, they need to get more accurate. If they poll this many more people, their margin of error or their confidence factor would be changed. Well, it would, but not to any great extent. So, and I'm putting this out to you folks, especially who work in education, because this has always fascinated me. Now, obviously, we don't want our education underfunded. I get that. I understand that. But is there a point where spending, you know, X amount of $1,000 per student and then spending X amount of $1,000 per student plus another $500 or plus another $1,000, is that the be-all and end-all? Do we have a notion or an exact idea that that's going to make any difference? Or are there other things that we should look at? And again, I'm not coming at this as any education expert here. But I found it kind of, I don't want to say funny because I don't think it's a laughing matter, but I found it kind of typical where a lot of the teachers' unions and a lot of the people in Hartford, the advocates, are saying, well, we're not doing enough for education. Well, don't they say that every year? And after a while, whether you, if you keep on saying, this is my point here, if you keep on saying the same thing over and over and over again, it's like that thing, you know, what do they call that, the one-note samba, that song out of the 50s or 60s in the Great American Songbook, whatever it is, it literally becomes like a one-note samba here. So the governor comes through yesterday. He wants to invest more money in education, special ed funding, universal preschool program, and free school breakfast, which I am completely in favor of. You know I've said this for years on this program and others. There's nothing wrong with feeding kids at breakfast. I know what you're going to say. Well, the parents should. Well, a lot of the parents are idiots. And a lot of the parents have no idea what their kids are eating and, you know, beyond their best intentions here, it doesn't work that way. But still, they say there's not enough here. So the governor wants to ramp up $160 million to fund K-12, $85 million to increase the need-based education cost-sharing grant, and he wants to do that, so he's coming to the table. But you have people that say, no, we need $500 million. And my point is, if you give them the $500 million, then you know what they're going to say? Likely, I don't know. But my guess would be, well, we need more. So if you can, or if you're an education professional, you tell me, how much is enough? Well, the number has to be high enough, Paul, to where the test scores go up. Okay. And does that mean money buys higher test scores? Or is it, as many social commentators have said on this show and on other shows on this station and in other areas, is money not the issue? Is it a family issue? Is it the family unit? Is it, you know, other factors in these kids' lives? See, I'm just throwing this out there because it always seems to be money, money, and money. Yeah, and I get it. Teachers have to get paid. And if you don't pay teachers enough money, they ain't going to teach. And if you don't pay paraprofessionals enough money, they're not going to want to be a paraprofessional. And you've got to pay school supers, and there are costs, and I get that. I understand that. But how much is enough? And that's a half serious, half rhetorical question. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. Kate Diaz was quoted in this story. Kate's been on this show. She's been on the radio station. She is the head union president of the Connecticut Education Association. And she says right here, quote, the cost of education has continually risen. The state's contribution has not kept pace. Well, okay, Kate, I get that. You're the union head. But at what point do we say enough? Like, there are other things in this state that have to be, paid for here. Francis in Stratford leads us off today. Francis, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Boy, could I should... Well, just forget that. Make sure the curriculum the curriculum fits the level of the class that kid is in, not the level that the teacher's at. And I love blackboards. Explain it on the blackboard. History's wonderful, but teach it right, not just by dates. Tell them a story. They'll remember the story.
So you think it's not so much a money thing here as to how it's done?
Exactly. Mm. And attention's a big thing with the kiddos. I mean, I don't know. I don't like computers at all. Not until maybe fifth or sixth grade.
Uh-huh.
Lower than that, I mean, keep it very at a level that is their level. You know what I'm saying? Not Facebook or TikTok or whatever the hell. You know, one and one is still two.
It still is.
Two and two is four.
You sure about that?
Yeah, I'm sure about that. And I think they ought to learn a lot about money.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you there. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of school systems are actually doing that now. They're putting in, for a little bit of the older kids, they're putting in, like a mandatory half credit or one credit of a finance course. Life lessons, right? Life tools.
And it doesn't have to be geometry.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Basic reading, basic math, even coloring books with great crayons because it relaxes the nervous.
That's what they give me here. That's what they give me here at the radio station. The boss gives me coloring books and crayons.
They got advanced ones now. Yeah. I look at them. I say, not bad.
It's not bad. All right, Francis, good to hear from you. Thank you, dear. Appreciate that. Yeah, we have our connoisseur media coloring books, and oddly enough, they all end up on my desk.